Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 29 million people who voted for President Obama in 2008 stayed home on Election Day. Many voters expressed dismay with the economy, saying their personal situation has worsened, and they feel like the powers that be aren't doing enough for them, for the middle class, for the poor, and for their communities. So on today's Your Call, we're continuing our agenda for a new economy by opening up the lines. We want to hear from you. Talk about what the election means for the economy, where are we today, and where are we going? What's really on your mind post-election, and what do you think is in store for the next 2 years? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What message do you think voters and non-voters sent on Election Day, and what's really at the top of your list when it comes to the economy? The gap between the rich and the poor in the U.S. is bigger than at any time since the 1920s. We've got 42 million Americans on food stamps. Thousands of people are still losing their homes. One in five children live in poverty. We also really want to talk about solutions. A lot of people, economists, say that we desperately need a public jobs program. We need infrastructure rebuilding. So we want to throw out some ideas today, talk about where we are right now, find out where you are, what you're thinking about, what's at the top of your list, and what you expect from the next 2 years. Also, what are some solutions? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I'd like to welcome Mark Weisbrot to the show. Mark is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Mark, what message did Tuesday send to you about where we are right now in terms of the economy?
Well, obviously, the voters were unhappy, and there was a lot of, you know, exit polling and pre-polling data that showed that it was kind of a protest vote. And there's a long literature in political science, of course, that shows that the economy is really the big issue in these elections. There was one study that looked at midterm elections going all the way back to 1950, shows that the economy, pretty much the state of the economy, is pretty much the main variable that determines how many seats the president's party will lose, and they usually do lose. So that pretty much drove this election, I think.
And there's so many numbers out there. I mean, dire statistics, dire numbers about everything from the gap between the rich and the poor to food stamps to poverty to foreclosures. How are you making sense of where we are right now?
Well, there's a simple way to look at it, and I think the media has missed a lot of this because they focused on the financial crisis itself. But really, the recession that we're looking at, which is sometimes called the Great Recession, because it's the worst we've had since the Great Depression. It was caused by the bursting of a big real estate bubble. That was the main cause. I mean, even if you didn't have any of these complex derivatives or subprime mortgages or weaknesses in the financial system, we would still be looking at a recession that would be the worst since the Great Depression. So some of those things made it worse. But that's the big thing, because what happened with this bubble is that we lost about $1.2 trillion in private spending annually. So that's huge. And about half of that is from construction, and the other half is mostly what people's response to having less housing wealth. They spend, you know, when the price of their house goes down, they spend less, and of course there were some stock market losses in there too, and that also causes people to spend less. So that was that's the simple story, and the other half of the simple story, and I think what led to this election result, is that the government stimulus, although you may see some big numbers in the media, if you look at what the government actually contributed to the economy in terms of government spending in this last year, for example, It was only about 1/8 the size of what we just lost. In other words, about $150 billion as opposed to $1,200 billion that we lost from the bursting of the real estate bubble. And that is just nowhere near enough. And so even though it did create some jobs, and by the way, when I say $150 billion, I'm taking off what the state and local governments did, because they actually subtracted from the stimulus by tightening their budgets. Most of them are required by law to have balanced budgets. So that's the simple story. We had a stimulus. It helped save somewhere between 1.4 and 3.3 million jobs, but it wasn't anywhere near sufficient.
And Mark, before we get into specifics, I'd love to talk to you today about the Fed, the gap between the rich and the poor, jobs, and tax cuts. But what do you think we should expect over the next 2 years? Because Republicans say that they want to roll back the health care law, for example. President Obama has indicated that he might compromise with the Republicans and extend the Bush tax cuts. What can we expect over the next 2 years?
Well, that's a tough call. It depends how much the administration and, to a certain extent, the congressional leaders, especially in the Senate, want to adopt any of the Republican agenda or whether they want to oppose it.
Well, what is their agenda? Because every time they're pushed on the Sunday shows to talk about what they would cut, they don't have an answer. They said, we're going to take a look at everything and then we'll make our decisions.
No, that's because there really isn't anything they do want to cut that wouldn't destroy them in an election. Very little. The kind of cuts that they're talking about tend to be rather small.
But can you give us any insight from your vantage point in D.C. about what they're planning to do? Are we just going to get complete gridlock for the next 2 years?
It's possible. I think that's a reasonably likely outcome. I'm more worried about, that wouldn't be the worst, really. A worst outcome would be if the administration decided to find common ground with the Republicans on reducing the deficit at a time when that would, make the economy even worse, or find common ground on cutting Social Security, which there's been hints that's a possible outcome. And these are things, I think, that would really hurt people.
Because President Obama's Deficit Commission is expected to offer recommendations by December 1st. And word on the street is that they are going to go after Social Security.
It seems likely. The people that he picked to run the thing are people who are likely to want to cut Social Security based on their past records. And this is something that won't help at all, and it's completely unnecessary. The Social Security program is good for at least 27 years without any changes whatsoever. And beyond that, it would take only small changes to bring it into balance, smaller than the changes that we made in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and so on. So there's really no long-term problem with Social Security. It's just a question that, we're living longer, and we have to, as we did in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, we adjusted the program in order to take into account that we're living longer. Nothing new and different here. It's just because of the massive disinformation that we've gotten for decades now on Social Security. Most people under 50 probably think that they're not even going to get their benefits, but there's really... program is quite solid. It's as solid as it's been at any time, really, in its whole, almost its whole 66 or 67-year history.
Now, Mark, you spend your days really looking at these issues. What's really at the top of your list in terms of, we're dealing with the Bush tax cuts, we've got jobs, we've got the gap between the rich and the poor, foreclosures, the list goes on. What really concerns you the most right now? What do you think we really need to spend our time focusing on?
Well, the biggest thing really is the economy, I'm afraid. Not only from an electoral and political point of view, but from a real point of view, this is the big problem. We could, if our government engages in the wrong policies And as it did in the last 2 years by not having a sufficient stimulus, we could face years more of stagnation. You know, recession is just a technical definition that's determined by the National Bureau of Economic Research. And so technically we came out of the recession, a very long recession, 2.5 years, in the middle of this year, around June. And that doesn't really mean anything to people because the economy is growing so slow and unemployment is so high that it still feels like a recession. So we could have this kind of growth or worse for years to come. And, of course, that affects everything. I mean, you know, not just employment, which is the most important thing to most people, but also wages, poverty. You know, wages don't grow. Poverty rises. People lose health insurance. People lose their homes. So that's the big, that's the most important thing. We have to get that right first. And then everything else is really important. Don't get me wrong. I mean, what's happened to income distribution in this country in the last 3 decades has been horrifying. And we have to address that as well. But that's getting worse, too, because at least at the bottom, because obviously when you have this kind of unemployment, it hurts the lower-income workers the most. So this would be my first priority, and I hope it's the Democrats' first priority as well.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners on this. We're speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're talking about what Tuesday means for the economy. Where are we right now? Where are we going? I'd love to find out what's on your mind post-election. How has your personal situation, your community, what has really changed? And where do you think we're going? What changes do you want to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And then if you have any questions about the economy, we got some questions on Friday about the Federal Reserve and the announcement to pump $600 billion into the economy between now and June to reduce long-term interest rates. And we'll also be talking about that. So if you have any questions about what we're dealing with right now, give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Habu in Wisconsin. Hi, Habu. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. You know, frankly, I wasn't surprised, and I embraced the results because we need to put fear of God into these politicians who seem to be deaf. Just imagine these Democrats who we had great expectations from didn't really respond to our needs. And what is, I think, the crux of the problem is unemployment. Mm-hmm. There's no way that they're going to change unemployment by pouring public monies, because there's no private sector. And if they do not address the problem of unemployment, we are marooned. That's all I have to say. I don't expect much to change, but now these people would at least be fearful, and they may be mindful to us little people. Thank you.
Well, Habu, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What changes would you like to see to improve the employment situation?
Well, this really comes, in my humble opinion, it comes down to the trade policy. Mm. We cannot just look at this. If you think that 20 years down the road we can continue like this, we are going to be completely an island. We are that way already. But we have to be an industrial country. We've got to have, you know, top quality manufacturing, and it has. And you know, it'd be one thing if we were in Nigeria, we would need to exchange goods, but we have enough demand within this country that even if we put up certain tariffs for things that are made elsewhere, we can create enough of an internal demand. And China can export to the rest of the world for all we care. But this whole notion of, you know, going to the lowest bidder, and it isn't as if Americans get a break when the products come back. This is making only Wall Street and these corporate offices very fat. So that has to change. And, you know, it isn't like going against gravity. these laws were written and unwritten in Congress, and so it can be done.
Well, thank you for calling in. And what about that, Mark? Because a couple of days ago, we just got word that Harley-Davidson is going to build its second assembly plant ever outside the United States in India. And this morning, Democracy Now! Had a segment on the corporate executives who were with Obama in India as he was signing trade deals. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that's affecting the economy? I mean, why would Harley-Davidson do something like this right now, taking their plant to India?
Well, they probably see that it's mostly probably driven by the fact that there's expanding markets there. And so they want to be able to produce for that market. And, of course, I don't know how much they're planning on producing for exports, but I'm sure they get lower wages and other production costs there as well. And I think the caller is right. I mean, the loss of manufacturing jobs that you've had in the United States and the redistribution of income upward that's resulted from that was the result of deliberate policy changes. Not only the trade and investment agreements that we've negotiated, like NAFTA and the WTO and others, but also the dollar. This is the other thing I think that a lot of people don't understand, but it's, and the press doesn't, just beginning to talk about it, but it's been a problem for many, many years, is that when your currency is overvalued, it makes imports very cheap, and it makes your exports more expensive, and well, that means that you're going to lose jobs in the tradable sector by running big trade deficits for many years, which is what we have done. And so that's a problem that we'll have to correct as well. I don't think we're going to lose our manufacturing. We've lost a lot of our manufacturing base in the last decade or 2 decades, if you want to look at that far back. But it's mostly a result of our currency overvaluation.
What about these jobs? Because Paul Craig Roberts, who was the Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan, came out with a piece a few days ago called America's Job Losses Are Permanent. And, I mean, he's got dire predictions about where we're going, saying that these jobs are not coming back, and the jobs that we do have are service-type jobs. You've got Wall Street, Silicon Valley service-type jobs, and 60 Minutes actually highlighted some people in Silicon Valley who used to be scientists who are now making $9.50 an hour at Target.
Yes. Well, I think he's not exactly right. I mean, the jobs could come back. It really depends on policy. And one of the, I mean, I think you have to understand when your currency is 25% overvalued, you know, that means that's the same thing as putting a tariff on your exports to other countries by 25%, okay? In other words, making your exports that much more expensive and also giving a subsidy of about that size to the imports, any country that wants to sell products in the U.S. So that's huge. You know, and our currency has been overvalued very often by more than that. So this is what happens when you do that for years and years. And it's only recently become an issue, but in a kind of a strange way where people just try to blame China and say that their currency is undervalued, which may be true. But the other side of that is the U.S. currency is overvalued. And we can change that anytime we want, with or without the cooperation of China.
So just quickly, because we get calls on this nonstop, how would this change where these jobs actually come back to the U.S.? I mean, what should people be talking about? What should they be demanding for this to happen? How could you do it?
I really think if in terms of that, well, there's a couple of them. I mean, the first thing is we still need a stimulus, because the economy is a wreck. And, you know, we have 9.6% unemployment and millions more than that who have either dropped out of the labor force or unemployed or underemployed. And we have people, millions more underwater in their homes. And so this is going to depend on more demand in this economy. Now, the import-export part of our economy can contribute to increasing that demand if we reduce our imports and we increase our exports, and that has to come about through a lowering of the value of the dollar. People have to understand that here, including policymakers. I mean, I've talked to members of Congress and staff who don't understand the importance of that, because we've been kind of brought up to believe that a strong dollar is sometimes somehow a good thing, but it isn't. It really does destroy our manufacturing base.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call, Habu, and let's go to our next caller, Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Just a quick comment about the Social Security issue. Obama had an opportunity, I believe, if he really had the will to do it, with both houses in Democratic hands, to raise the tax rate on income for Social Security. That could have solved the Social Security problem with just one act if he had raised it, which is now, I think, the top level is just a little over $100,000. If they had raised it substantially, or not even substantially, it just doubled it. It would have made an enormous impact on the money's coming into Social Security. But anyway, that's one issue. The other one that I wanted to comment on was with regard to the stimulus in the United States and where this could have come from. I think I heard your guest say that the stimulus was not sufficient, and I would agree. I think there were two areas that which I don't think is going to happen now. It's just unfortunate. But one was there should have been a massive infrastructure stimulus done. And I mean, I know that people on your program have said this before, but I mean, there's just hundreds of billions of dollars of needed infrastructure improvements in this country, and that could have provided who knows how many jobs to people. The other is that if they had really been serious about a green economy, they could have gone gung-ho on that and done just as much with money in that area as they could have done with infrastructure, and the impact on both the economy and on our environment would have been absolutely astounding.
You
so
know,
anyway, those are my contributions.
Greg, thank you so much. We did a live broadcast from the Green Festival yesterday or Saturday, and we heard this over and over again. And Mark, someone from Food and Water Watch said that over the next 10 years, the U.S. has to spend $300 billion on upgrading the water system, and hardly any politicians are even talking about that.
Yes, I agree with that, and also the caller is exactly right. It's really it's a sad thing. It's a missed opportunity. This is a case where the more seemingly bold plan, which would be investing in this infrastructure that we need and investing in alternative energy, and would have been the less risky thing politically, as it turns out, because you can see, I mean, they lost 63 seats in the House. And a number of senators as well. So the strategy of being timid clearly failed. And so no matter what you say, you know, you can say that, well, they could have, you know, they couldn't, this was the best that the president could have done given the Republican opposition, but they should have tried. They didn't try this. If they had tried it and made it clear that this is what the economy needs, and if you didn't do it, this is what we're going to be looking at, what we're seeing today, I think the president and his party would have been in a position, a much stronger position right now.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. And we're talking today with Mark Weisbrot. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And we wanted to open the phone lines today to find out what's on your mind post-election. What do you think the election means for the economy? Where are we right now? And where are we going? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. KALW is now on Facebook. You can become a Facebook fan of KALW and help spread the word about the programming that you value on local public radio. It's easy to become a fan. Either search KALW the next time you're on Facebook or follow the link to the station's page from kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Sandeep Roy will have a conversation with war correspondent Anna Botkin. She's out with a new book called Peace Meals, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs and Other War Stories. What are the effects of war on civilians? Anna writes about war, humanity, and food. So she'll be sharing stories about the many people that she's met during her reporting, and also what stories would actually resonate with the public here as Iraq and Afghanistan have mostly disappeared from the front pages. That's tomorrow. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, we're doing a two-part special on the state of the women's movement. Where are we right now? How did we get here? Where are we going? And what should our priorities be for the women's movement? We're going to have intergenerational conversations. And if you have any guest ideas for that, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. But today we are continuing our Monday series, Agenda for a New Economy, by talking about what the election tells us about the economy. Where are we now? Where are we going? What do you expect in the next 2 years? And just if you've got any general questions about the economy, how has it changed your life and those around you? And what's in store? 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have full lines right now, so if you get a busy signal, call back in just a couple of minutes and we'll get through as many callers as we can. And today we're joined by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And let's hear from Karen in Alameda. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Good morning. This is what I think. We're spending $83 billion a month of federal tax dollars to carry on two illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, $83 billion a month. We're giving $10 million a day to Israel. I don't know if a lot of people know that out there. They get $10 million of tax dollars a day. We give $30 billion to Pakistan. We give billions here, billions there. Federal matching funds for the states have just about dried up. That's what's causing the huge shortfall in state budgets. It's federal matching funds. So it's not as if we don't have money for Medicare or Social Security or public schools or teachers or helping the poor. We got plenty of money. We are just wasting it and squandering it to commit genocide in the Middle East. It's not helping our economy. Personally, I have my own business. I work 7 days a week, so I'm not out on the street, and my business is down 80%. I'm just about hanging on. I talk to people all over the country because I have an online business. Everyone's losing their jobs. There's millions and millions of Americans out there. The government has done nothing. The president has done nothing. He squandered the mandate that he had to have bold change from the draconian policies of the Bush administration. He's hung on to all those bad policies. No Child Left Behind, the Patriot Act, Guantanamo is still open and percolating, holding people that were never even charged with anything. So it's very disheartening, it's depressing, and it's infuriating to people, Americans, whose tax dollars support the president's salary and pay for the congressman, who I might add now are on a week vacation paid for by the government. They won't be back till the 15th. We're talking about the economy. We're worried about it. They ought to be in an emergency session. And I don't know anybody that isn't furious with the – and we're, this last election, we're going to be back 100 years. They don't even recognize global warming. And now that they're talking about the economy to get themselves elected with the Tea Party, what are they going to do? They're going to reverse health care. That's going to be their first order of business.
Right. So, well, Karen, let me ask you. You said business is down 80%. What do you do exactly?
No, I do. I'm a restoration, a textile restoration specialist.
Okay.
So I repair, you know, clothes and blankets and quilts and this and that, and I have an online business.
Hmm.
And I have to say that in the last 2 years, my business has basically plummeted. So I have other jobs to keep me going, so I can keep my business going. But I'm not alone. At least I have some kind of work.
Right.
But I have many people who said, oh, I was going to do this, but I just lost my job. This is Florida, Wisconsin, Virginia, Wyoming. I talk to people all over the country. I hear the same thing. My husband just lost his job. We're going to be kicked out of our house. And the whole subprime mortgage thing that was created by the banks and approved by the regulators, the government regulators, none of those people are in jail. None of them.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
so
Karen,
that's my concern.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm so sorry to hear what you're dealing with. I mean, you're right. So many people are dealing with this. And we got an email from Kat in San Jose who says, I think it's disgusting that over $1 billion, it's actually $4 billion, was spent on the election while most of our country is suffering just to get by. And Mark, why don't you comment on specifically Karen's comments about military, because President Obama's military budget is larger than President Bush's. And Joseph Stiglitz, who co-wrote a book with Linda Bilmes, Joseph Stiglitz, an economist, Linda Bilmes, a public policy professor at Harvard, they had a book, The $3 Trillion War, a few years ago. And they say that actually these wars are going to cost about $6 trillion when you factor everything in.
Yes, just full disclosure, Joe Stiglitz is actually on our advisory board. And it's true, your caller said, this is an enormous waste. I mean, these are wars that have been tremendously destructive. There's no end in sight in the Afghanistan war. It's not even clear that we're leaving Iraq in the sense that we're keeping, you know, 50,000 troops there and other personnel for indefinitely. And in fact, you know, I mean, most people agree now that war was completely unnecessary. And so, yeah, this is a huge drain. Obviously, some of it is spending. It actually does, unfortunately, contribute to the economy. But a lot of it, all of this money could be used to create more employment if it were deployed here at home, and you wouldn't have all these people being killed.
Just last week, the U.S. announced plans to bolster its presence in Afghanistan with a $500 million expansion of its embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, and the construction of two consulates.
Yeah, it's terrible. And, you know, it's not the majority opinion in the U.S. either. In the last New York Times CBS poll, you had 54% said we should just get out of Afghanistan altogether. This is something that, you know, it was taken off the table in this election, partly because both the politicians and the media didn't talk about it. And obviously it's easy to focus people's attention on the economy when it's a wreck like this. And, but also, I mean, there's been this, I think that the people in power and the press have succeeded in keeping the reality of the war away from people. You know, if you're not one of the 1% of the country that's somehow directly connected to the war, you know, having family over there or being there, you don't really see the effect of it at all. We're not even being taxed for it, really.
Right.
And this is kind of unprecedented, really, in the history of our warfare, this level of censorship. And, you know, even during Vietnam, we saw the images. And, you know, you can see in 2006, it was a factor in the election when the Democrats took Congress for the first time, because at that time there was a lot of violence in Iraq, and it was being shown on the television. And people turned against the war immediately when they just actually saw what was going on. That's all it really takes, is for people to be aware of it. So it really does take a major kind of censorship. I'm not saying it's conspiratorial or deliberate, although some of it obviously is on the part of the government. But it takes that kind of a whiteout of this, of the actual violence, to be able to get away with these wars for so long.
Well, we're talking about this tomorrow with our guest Anna Bodkin, who's a war correspondent. She spent a lot of time in Iraq. What about in D.C., though? Do you expect the conversation to change at all with any of these new politicians, some of the more libertarian politicians? I mean, will they stick to these principles of no nation building and cutting the military budget? Rand Paul was asked about this, and he said everything's on the table, but you can't get specifics out of anybody.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I do, there is definitely a libertarian streak in the Tea Party, for example, and those people would like to cut military spending, but what happens is the Republican Party, I think they're going to rein in the people who want to cut military spending. They now have control of the House, which is going to make it harder to get these bills like the McCain, the McGovern, the Feingold-McGovern bill. Now Feingold is gone from the Senate. This was the bill that said that you had to have, the administration had to set a deadline for getting out of Afghanistan, not beginning to withdraw, but getting out. And that got, 60% of the Democrats in the House, against the wishes of the administration, voted for that bill. So over the long term or intermediate term, I'm still optimistic that the effort to get us out of Afghanistan, which is a really result of, organizing all around the country. People put pressure on their congressional representatives. That's what got 60% of the Democrats in the House to vote. You don't see it because they're not in the streets, but that's what's going on. And that will continue, and the Americans, disillusionment with this war will continue, and I think we will be forced, the administration will be forced to get out.
And that is Mark Weisbrot. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And today we're talking about what the elections mean for the economy, where are we right now, and where are we going. And now I would like to welcome Nomi Prinz to the show. Nomi is author of It Takes a Pillage: Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. She's also a senior fellow at DEMOS, a nonpartisan public policy think tank. Hi, Nomi. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much.
Hi. So, Nomi, it's been, I think, a couple of years since we had you on to talk about your book. We should let listeners know that you used to work on Wall Street, so you really have a good grasp of what goes on there. How did you assess the election, and what does this really mean for the next 2 years when it comes to economic issues?
Well, I think for the most part, obviously the Republicans that are coming in have talked about the notion of two things, really. One is that they don't like regulations, which is really nothing new. And the other thing is that they are going to look at dialing back some of the bills that have been passed. Most notably, though, they focused on the health care, or I should say the health insurance bill, a little bit less than anything on the financial or bank-related bill. And that's primarily because, I think for the most part are going to leave the banks alone. But I also think that the reform bill, for the most part, leaves the banks alone. So in that respect, it's not going to be a tremendous change.
And we've had people call in talking about their jobs. One woman called in and said she's losing about 80% of business, and she's hearing from people all across the country who are losing their jobs. We also had callers comment on military spending and how hardly anybody is taking that on. Do you see any changes on those two fronts? And what do you think really needs to happen?
Well, I think there's this whole illusion, and before the elections, during the elections, and I think after the elections in Washington, that spending to help individuals is somehow, padded spending and unnecessary spending, and spending to help the military, the wars, the subsidies that Wall Street still receives, some through the Fed, some through guarantees to the Treasury Department, but still going on, is somehow off the table. So what I'd like to see happen is for some realization that you can actually help the general economy, help people who don't have jobs, who are losing jobs, funding for states, funding for various budgets on that respect, while you can still cut unnecessary funding from the military and draw back even more from a military aspect, where you can rein in some of what's going on Wall Street, where you can slap necessities onto these banks that at the moment have their own ability to decide who gets foreclosed upon, which loans get restructured, having received just a massive, massive pile of money that they still enjoy, today as we are speaking, to have gotten out of the problems that they created and amassed and are sitting sort of on the remains of right now. So what I'd like to see is for some realization that we put trillions of dollars into the wrong pot, and not this notion from the people coming into Congress and who have been there that that didn't happen, that didn't exist, that because it became from perhaps another pot in Washington, it doesn't get to be analyzed and discussed. I'd like to see the Fed analyzed. It's something that was agreed upon by members of the Democratic Party and by, you know, libertarian Republicans like Ron Paul, and isn't really going forward. The Fed's still opening its pocketbook, creating more debt, allowing more debt to be created by buying it, and it's not going into the pockets of ordinary Americans or restructuring ordinary debt or allowing ordinary people to move forward.
And can you briefly talk about the recent announcement by the government about the Fed announcing it will pump $600 billion into the economy between now and June? What is your assessment of that? We got a few calls on this on Friday, and a few people said, take a look at Robert Reich's piece, and he says, quote, Washington's latest jobs program is not coming out of Congress or the White House. America's political branches are in gridlock. It's coming out of the Federal Reserve. He says the Fed's jobs program is designed to keep interest rates low by pumping even more money into the economy. The Fed will buy up Treasury bills and other long-term debt to reduce long-term interest rates. Unfortunately, he says that won't work. It'll just pump up another speculative bubble. How do you read this?
Yeah, I think the most important sentence in what you just read from what he wrote is that it is propping up a bubble. There's a bubble going right now. When you think of bubble, I mean illusion, that there are By maintaining low rates, by pumping money not into the economy. The Fed can say all day long it's pumping into the economy. The Treasury Department can echo that it is pumping into the economy. The reality is it is pumping into the banking system. And as we have seen very painfully over the last 2 years since the bailout and subsidization of a really reckless financial sector occurred, this cheap money that wallows through Wall Street from Washington is just simply not helpful to the rest of the economy, because it doesn't find its way into the rest of the economy because the banks don't have to and therefore do not share. So what the Fed is doing, and I really think Bernanke is going to be known, if he isn't right now to some of us, but to all of us at some point in the future, is one of the most dangerous people to our economy out of this entire crisis period. The idea that the Fed will now be sitting on nearly $1 trillion worth of our debt, that it's being printed in the Treasury Department, and it's being bought by the Federal Reserve, which will keep down rates, which will keep down the value of the dollar, which will give an illusion to the markets, because they love pumping cheap money into speculative activities up, that is somehow going to boost our economy. Is like, I mean, I don't know. It's like he's a complete moron who nobody is really reining in. You know, I have gotten, and I've written, you know, about many aspects of this crisis and the bailout of the financial system. And I think this latest move, the day after the elections, when everybody is focused on, you know, who in the Tea Party got a seat in the Senate, for the Fed to just abjectly say, oh, and by the way, we're going to, like, put more pretend, you know, stimulus into the economy, and no one is stopping it. I mean, I would love it for, like, someone in the old Senate or the new senators coming in to just hear March in there and just ask him what exactly it is he's trying to do and why he's so hell-bent on destroying the economy.
Well, Representative Alan Grayson took him on last year, and he lost his seat in Florida, so who knows if anyone's going to take his place.
I know, and that was a very sad aspect of the election. Russ Feingold, who, you know, didn't go after Bernanke so much as one of the few senators that voted against the bailout on the Democratic side in 2008, unfortunately also lost his seat.
And that is Nomi Prinz, author of It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. We're also joined by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And let's take a few back-to-back calls, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's go to Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph. Thanks for holding.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Lawrence.
Hi, Lawrence.
How you
Lawrence
doing?
In Berkeley. Hi.
Yeah,
sorry about that.
Yeah, what I wanted to say, you know, the joke of the day is that there are these Somali pirates that are on trial in New York, and all they have to do is incorporate as a bank, and they'll be let off with an apology and given billions of dollars.
Yeah.
But the problem is that would happen under both Democrats and Republicans, and that's why people didn't vote, because both parties now are completely captured by the banks and by the corporations. And for that reason, if anybody who voted, if the base that voted for Obama is ever going to vote again, there's going to have to be a primary challenge to Obama. And what dismays me almost as much as the election is Obama's after-the-election comments, which show that, in essence, he's been kidnapped by the banks and by the corporations, and he has Stockholm syndrome. He can't think in any other way except the way that he's been taught to think by the Treasury Secretary and these people that the banks put in exchange for the money that they gave him for the election. I mean, he actually said that the reason people voted for the Republicans is because we bailed out the banks and because we bailed out General Motors and because of the stimulus program, people began to think that they were losing their freedom and they're not used to having the government interfering with their freedom. I mean, that is pure Republican think and pure bank think. It means, first of all, you know, first of all, they want to eliminate all those programs. And second of all, he's making equal an individual with a corporation. In other words, if you put some restrictions on a corporation, you're putting it on an individual because corporations are human beings. That's Republican. That's bank think. He has been kidnapped, and he has Patty Hearst syndrome. We have to have a primary challenge. Well, nobody will vote again.
Well, thank you for calling in, Lawrence. And some people are saying we might actually have four people running, because if the Tea Party runs, somebody in the Republican Party will run. So we might actually have four people running. And we'll get comments after I take a few more calls. Thank you again. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show. Hi, Max. Nope. Sorry about that, Max. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco.
Yes,
hi, Harry.
With regard to your first guest, when it comes to a liberal think tank, he says that Social Security is okay for 27 years. Well, I think, you know, he needs to have a position paper where they show why that is true in a way that, you know, holds up, and also what you can do after that 27 years. Similarly, I'm wondering about Medicare. With regard to manufacturing, I would say the biggest export is defense, and that Obama seems to be the salesperson for that when he goes to these various countries. There's a great new documentary that everyone should see called Inside Job. It's really a superlative documentary about what happened with the financial system. And I wanted to ask him with regard to saying the dollar is overvalued, because I don't see that, because the dollar has gone down against a lot of currencies by 25%, and Chinese wages are under $100 a month. And those things could not be easily retooled to make here, nor would they be economical given what the Chinese are paid. So I don't understand why the currency is overvalued. It seems to me the government wants to push down the value of the dollar against the Chinese yuan, because the Chinese hold all these treasury bills, and they're going to lose 25% on them. But I wonder what his view is, because I'm kind of surprised that a liberal think tank would be supporting that.
Okay, well, thank you. We have an email on that also, and we'll ask right after we take one more call. Let's go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Mark Weisbrot, what he thinks when he was talking about the jobs problem in the economy, of how much of that was affected by the fact that we don't have single-payer health care, how many of the jobs would still be secured, and how much went into GM going bankrupt because the company had to pay high insurance for its employees. And the new Obama health care thing is going to plummet the economy and is not going to save any of the jobs. And I was just wondering what the thoughts were on the effect that's having on the jobs problems.
Okay, thank you, Ruthann. Mark, do you want to take that one, and then we'll get to the other questions?
Sure, just that question, the one that was just asked?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the fact that the insurance cost that GM and the other auto companies have had to pay have been a huge problem. I mean, they're competing with other countries that don't companies in other countries don't have the same huge healthcare costs. So a single payer system would help. Would definitely help. I don't think that the Obama plan is going to sink the economy, but it does have the problem, and it will actually provide some improvements, but it won't. It doesn't look like it will resolve the long-term cost problem that has, you know, the United States spending twice as much as other high-income countries on health care.
And what about Harry's question about why currency is overvalued? We got an email from a listener who says that you might be overlooking the difference in wage benefits between the U.S. and China, which is like 15 to 1, meaning a person earning a modest $20 an hour plus 10 for benefits, which equals 30 per hour in the U.S. On the other hand, a person working in China makes $2 per hour at that. Hence, the difference is 15 times.
Well, it isn't that simple because you don't have necessarily the same productivity in China that you have in the United States in a whole variety of industries. In some you could, in which case the currency wouldn't make any difference. But for the most part, the overvaluation of the dollar has been the main factor, even more than the trade agreements, and remains, I think, the main factor that has led to the chronic trade deficit of the United States, which has gone down, you know, of course, during the recession because our imports shrank, but will come back up if and when the economy recovers. And so it's a serious problem. And when I say it's overvalued, I mean, one way of seeing that is just the deficits themselves. You know, that's by definition, if you run chronic trade deficits for years and years and years, your currency is overvalued.
All right. And I just want to get, and we should do a show on this because we often get calls on this. And Nomi Prinz, final thoughts from you. Lawrence called in and said both parties are captured by the banks. 20 seconds. Where are we going from here?
I think he's right that they are, and I think where we go from here, unfortunately, is more of the same. I don't see if there couldn't be a real slapdown of the banking system, a division of banks into speculative investment and commercial banks, a requirement of banks to share the cheap money that it should not have gotten to begin with. If that's not going to be a policy, which it hasn't been by either the Democrat or the Republican Party, I don't see much of that changing.
And we're going to have to leave it there. That's Nomi Prinz, author of It Takes a Pillage, and Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you for joining us. And here's what's coming up tomorrow. What are the effects of war on civilians? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with war correspondent Anna Bodkin about her new book, Piecemeals, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs and Other War Stories, a travelogue about war and food. How do people manage to persevere in extreme situations? Join us at 11 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. How do stories about people living in war zones help us understand the impact of war on civilian populations? And what stories would actually resonate with the public? It's Your Call with Sandy Proy and you.